to remember. Kyla had given Kiera to her vampire-hunting friends in order to take Kiera's place. Kiera's place with Saxon, somewhere called Dark Moon Vale, and she had gotten a tattoo. Kyla had. Kiera stared at her own healthy wrist, studying the markings of Cetus the sea monster. The emblem was definitely still there. She rubbed her temples, her forehead was beginning to ache, as she strained to reassemble the scattered pieces of the mysterious puzzle. Xavier had taken her to his lab. He had wanted to study her blood. He had said something about a destiny, whatever that was, and he had hurt her. Dear God, how he'd hurt her. And then that cosmic voice, that disembodied sound, it had whispered in Kiera's mind. Try to reach Saxon. Your bond is strong. He may be your only hope. She had tried, but she had failed. Only he was sitting here now right beside the bathtub. He was with her in Owen's warehouse. Her head throbbed, the room swayed, and another memory assailed her. Brutality. Being carved up. John, Mike, and Nick eager to defile and rape her. The room had turned black, the music muting in the distance. Then Saxon had leaped onto the table. He had bitten her. He had tortured her. She stood up in the tub, scrambling to escape another captor, and she almost careened backward into the enclosure wall. But Saxon was there in an instant. He caught her trembling frame and reached for a nearby bath towel. Kiera, slow down, baby. You're under the influence of a sedative. Come here. He motioned her forward, still bracing her by the shoulders. Step over the rim. Slowly. Be careful. She obliged him on trembling legs, not knowing who or what to trust, but certain she couldn't fight him. Okay, he encouraged kindly. Now just stand still. Lean against the counter. Hang on while I dry you off. He patted her down with the towel as best he could, avoiding any place too intimate. Then he wrapped another towel around her recently shampooed hair and draped her in a clean terry cloth robe. There was nothing menacing about him. Despite what she knew, what she sort of remembered, Saxon was being gentle and caring, infinitely patient. Kiera forced her fear aside. Right now, what she needed were answers, and she had no doubt that Saxon had them.
"We need to get out of here,"
she finally whispered, gesturing toward the bathroom door.
"You don't understand. The men in this warehouse, they were all vampire hunters. Saxon, Kyla is a vampire hunter, and their leader, their headhunter, he's a man named Xavier. And as impossible as this sounds, he's a werewolf. I know it sounds crazy, but I saw it myself. I actually watched him shift."
"Shh, shh, shh," Saxon murmured. "It's okay. Everything's all right. Just breathe, baby. I know. We're several steps ahead of you. And we are going to get the heck out of Dodge. We only stayed because I had to convert you, and we needed to make sure you were stable. After that, I wanted to wash the blood and sweat from your hair. Get the grime off your body. In the meantime, Nathaniel brought you a bottle of Valium from a nearby pharmacy, and Julian hotwired a couple SUVs. So you and I can talk privately while we drive, and the two of them can follow. We know all about Xavier, and we're keeping an eye out. But for now, I just need you to come with me. I promise, Kiera, everything will be explained. And I swear on the souls of my parents, you are safe."
Kiera blinked several times, her mind shutting down from the overload. Nathaniel, Julian, they hotwired a car? And what the hell did he mean he converted her? Kiera was a strong woman, and she rarely, if ever, felt faint. Yet for some inexplicable reason, her stomach roiled, her knees buckled, and the floor shifted beneath her. Oh shit. She was going to pass out. The last thing she saw was the bathroom wall spinning as Saxon lunged forward to catch her.
31.
Saxon Olaru, one of Napoleon's sentinels, placed his destiny in Julian Lacusta's arms, confident that the Valium would keep her under, and asked the tracker to take her to the first SUV.
"Cover her in a warm blanket, and make sure her head is resting comfortably on a pillow. I still have some unfinished business."
He immediately turned his attention to Owen's vaulted ceiling and stared icily at the naked, unconscious human hanging from the rafters, as if on a cross. Owen's arms were spread-eagled and pinned to the wall, pierced with a pair of bronzed candlesticks. Both shoulders had been dislocated from the drag of his weight, and his feet dangled weakly beneath him. Something like a letter opener, or was that some kind of tuning fork, was dissecting his penis like a piercing. His mouth was oozing blood, and from the sounds of his breathing, Saxon figured Nathaniel had cut out his tongue. The sentinel glanced over his shoulder at the stainless steel table, the place where he had converted Kiera, and he snarled, remembering the brutality of the painful, exhausting process, how perilously close his destiny had come to dying. More than once,
"Nathaniel," he barked, "take Owen down. In fact, wake his ass up. Remove the candlesticks and let him fall to the floor."
Nathaniel flew to the top of the ceiling, smacked the human briskly across the cheek, and breathed ice-cold swirls of air up his nostrils until he jolted awake with a start. Moving so quickly the motion was a blur, the vampire extracted both candlesticks from his palms and watched with indifference as the broken body hurled downward and crumpled against the floor. There was a sickening crunch, several unnatural pops, and a scarlet pool of blood began to expand all around him. But thank the gods of fortune and vengeance, the human was still alive. Saxon glided across the room, as silent as a panther, snatched the human by the back of his neck and placed a vial of smelling salts beneath his nose, courtesy of Nathaniel's breaking and entering at the local pharmacy. He dragged Owen across the warehouse floor, flung him onto the table, and encircled his wrists with the chains, quickly moving downward to tether his flaccid ankles in the blood-stained leather loops. Then he bent down slowly, commanded the vampire hunter's gaze, and reveled in the visage of his terrified pupils.
"Do you know who I am?"
Saxon snarled savagely. Owen didn't react quickly enough, so Saxon cuffed him, causing a perceptible ringing in the human's ears.
"Do you know who I am?" he repeated.
Owen's body began to convulse in terror.
"I am a vampire from the House of Jaden, the species you pretend to be hunting, while you torture a helpless, innocent woman."
He flashed his fangs for effect and began to speak in a thick Count Dracula accent.
"I am the Grim Reaper, the creature of your nightmares, and the instrument of your death. I am the mate of the woman you tortured."
Owen's eyes bulged in his head, and his teeth literally chattered as he twisted and bucked in fevered urgency, trying to come off the table. Saxon snickered, deep, low, and sinister.
"No,"
he barked angrily, his accent growing thicker.
"We are only getting started."
He turned his attention to Nathaniel, who was watching from a distance, standing beside a large iron candle holder with six red wax candles decorating the cups.
"Vampire, toss me the two thickest candles."
Nathaniel did as Saxon asked, and the sentinel laid them on Owen's stomach. Placing a finger over his lips, he furrowed his brows in concentration.
What is it you said to my destiny? What did I find in her memories?"
He smiled a lascivious grin.
"Ah, yes. You wanted John, Mike, and Nick to all defile her at once."
He shrugged an apathetic shoulder, slowly scanning Owen's naked body.
"Sadly, I don't think you can accommodate three violations. But we'll work with what we've got."
Owen grunted, shaking his head violently from side to side in protest. Saxon cuffed him again. He lifted the longest of the two thick candles and gripped it in the palm of his hand.
"Relax your throat,"
he snarled, and without hesitation, he shoved it into Owen's bloody mouth, breaking his teeth as he worked it deeper and deeper into the human's gullet. Owen jackknifed off the table and gagged as Saxon thrust the candle in and out, again and again, in a vulgar parody of copulation.
"Yeah, just like that,"
he parroted, taking the words from Owen's memories.
Is it good for you, Owen? Would you like it harder?
Owen continued to gag and weep, even as he struggled to draw desperate, piteous breaths through his flaring nostrils. Saxon lifted the other candle from the human's stomach, stared at it, and winced. Leveling his glance a little lower, he grimaced.
This is just not going to fit.
He turned to regard Nathaniel.
Brother of my house, any idea how this works? I mean, somewhere, at some time, someone must have tried it. Humans do get off on the weirdest things. Thoughts?
Nathaniel shrugged his shoulder and frowned.
Maybe with some lube, some Vaseline.
He cocked his head to the side at a curious angle.
Nah, not gonna work. Maybe with a shoehorn.
He shook his head and whistled a dramatic, disturbing melody.
Hell, that won't work either. That shit is bigger than his entire left ass cheek.
His voice grew cold and indifferent.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but any way you turn it, that just defies the laws of physics.
Saxon murmured, as if contemplating it further.
I think you're right. But then, he is a big bad vampire hunter, correct? So, he can take it like a man. Besides, I imagine he's watched every Dracula movie ever made, and he's just dying to meet Vlad, the Impaler. Perhaps we should give him his wish.
Nathaniel chuckled and turned away. Despite the vampire's sadistic proclivities, he clearly had no desire to witness the desecration. As Owen grunted, groaned, and screamed around the first protruding candle, Saxon shoved the second one where the sun would never shine and twisted it back and forth for good measure, forcing it deeper and deeper until the wax disappeared.
Ew.
He grimaced, shaking out his hands, then washing them in a nearby basin.
Disgusting. I think he just soiled himself. Or maybe that was just inevitable.
Owen groaned in unspeakable pain. There was no doubt the candle had punctured his colon, and he was suffering from internal bleeding. Saxon turned around and glided across the warehouse, retrieving Kiera's violin. He removed it from the case, plucked a taut string to hear it vibrate, and then brought it back to the stainless steel table. Wielding it by the neck like a club, he drew back his arm and bashed it over Owen's head, splintering the wood into a handful of jagged pieces. He tested a particularly sharp, splintered section against the tip of his finger and nodded. As Owen grunted and squirmed, sobbed and choked, and suffocated beneath the first ghastly candle, Saxon carved all the symbols he had found in Kiera's body deep into the human's flesh, using the broken violin as his scalpel. When finally there was nothing left but a bloody, expiring, carved-up torso, he backed away from the table.
"Let's get the hell out of here,"
he said to Nathaniel, making his way toward the busted elevator door, planning to fly down the channel.
"Want me to clean up this mess?"
Nathaniel asked. Saxon shook his head.
"No. Leave him to die on his own. It won't be long. Besides, maybe his comrades will find him."
He froze then, dropped his head in his hand, and closed his eyes.
"Shit. I almost forgot."
"What?" Nathaniel asked, gliding up to his side.
"We need to make a stop by the hospital on the way to Darkmoon Vale. Something I pulled out of Owen's memories."
Nathaniel cocked his brows in question.
"Two other so-called hunters. They were here earlier, eager to participate in Kiera's torture. A female named Rachel and a male named Travis. He was one of her original captors until she stabbed him."
Nathaniel nodded knowingly, his dark predatory eyes gleaming with lethal shadows.
"They're at Denver General, presumably in the ER, but this night they will exit in body bags. I don't want to leave my destiny's side, not again, but I cannot let them live until morning."
Saxon curled his fingers inward and extended his arm to the side, and Nathaniel met the offering with a fist bump. In the blink of an eye, an unspoken exchange, Saxon transferred the psychic information through the contact, a clear visual picture of Rachel Collins and Travis Landon, so that the ancient master warrior could not mistake them.
"Quick and easy?"
Nathaniel asked.
"Slow and painful," Saxon said.
"Done,"
Nathaniel promised.
"In fact, if you're comfortable driving for a while, with Julian following behind you in the second SUV, then go ahead and hit the freeway. I'll catch up. My father and Nikari will be here shortly. They're going to try and find Xavier. Julian offered to track him for the House of Jaden, but..."
His voice grew as dark as black satin.
"I know what he did to your female, but Kitaro has claimed the right to blood vengeance. For himself, for Ariel, for Nikolai."
His tone lightened marginally.
"My guess. The Lycan's punk ass is already back in Mir."
Saxon nodded.
"Probably. He's obviously a coward."
"Yeah,"
Nathaniel muttered.
"Considering that he comes from a primordial species of vampire hunters, and he's an alpha male at that, he's a real gutless wonder. But he cannot hide forever."
There was nothing else spoken between them. There was nothing else that needed to be said.
32. Sunrise the next morning.
"I still can't believe she tried to stab a sleeping baby," Kiera whispered, sitting up in Saxon's bed and leaning against the headboard. She had been in Darkmoon Vale for most of the night, while she and Saxon stayed up talking. Luckily, and while it may have circumvented Saxon's original plans, she had slept all the way there as they drove, so it wasn't a hardship on her newly converted body. Her newly converted body. She could still hardly believe those words. Kiera was now a vampire. She was a warrior sentinel's destiny. The proof of the preordained connection was etched into her wrist. It hadn't been a Greek tattoo at all, but a perfect match to the moon and stars. That night she had been too alarmed to notice. And she had been claimed by Saxon Olaru because of an ancient curse. They had 22 days left. Well, 20 to be exact, if one made allowances for the 48-hour pregnancy, to produce a required sacrifice and turn it over to the blood. The males in the House of Jaden were ancient. The males in the House of Jaeger were evil. And Xavier belonged to an ancient species of werewolves, primal, genetic, vampire-hunting enemies. Was she leaving anything out? Oh yeah, Kyla. Her twin was in fact a human vampire hunter. She had orchestrated the Night of Saxon's Blood Moon for her own nefarious purposes, and she was now being guarded in the House of Jaden's jail, an archaic holding cell beneath an impenetrable ancient compound belonging to the vampire king. And she was awaiting Princess Siapori's blood vengeance. Kiera rubbed the bridge of her nose, trying to keep everything straight. Thus far, Saxon had been infinitely patient, clear, and concise, and immediately responsive to all of Kiera's volatile reactions and changing moods. When he had explained the conversion, what it meant and what took place, Kiera had wept for an hour. Yet in spite of his own exhaustion, he had held her hand, rubbed her shoulders, and soothed her, the entire time, with his voice. When she had learned about the requisite pregnancy and its 48-hour gestation, she had reacted with shock and revulsion. Yet he had kept the conversation factual in nature, answering all her questions and assuring Kiera that she would choose the time, setting, and desired amount of awareness when it came to the birth of the Dark One. It was the only thing he could have said to console her, and he somehow just knew that intuitively. When she'd learned about the houses of Jaden and Jaeger, the fact that Saxon Olaru had the curse of letters H-O-J physically inscribed on his heart, she had run from the room, dashing around the house like a demented bird. She had tried to smash out 3 windows and set off a series of alarms, and ultimately tossed a cup of hot water in the warrior's face, before stabbing at his eye with a spoon. Yeah, that had been a low point. Yet once again, he had remained at a safe, non-threatening distance, only intervening when her well-being was at stake. And bless his H.O.J. heart, he had washed the spoon and given it back, along with a fresh hot cup of ginger mint tea. His patience knew no boundaries. When he had described Napoleon Mondragon, who Xavier truly was, and spoken about his fearsome sentinel brothers, the work they all did for the king, she had waved a finger in his face,
planted her hands on her hips, and told him in no uncertain terms that she would never, ever venture out of the house or speak to any of them, so he may as well just take her back. He had met it all with placid reserve. And finally, when she'd asked him to sit outside the bedroom door and speak to her from a distance, because she didn't want to see his face, he had simply obliged her. And the thing of it was, Kiera wasn't flighty by nature, not in the slightest, at least not usually. She wasn't prone to mood swings or violent demonstrations, and she wasn't typically unstable. When she told him that truth, he'd believed her. It was simply impossible to hate him. And now, as she sat on his bed, wearing his way too large pajamas, because she didn't want to touch anything he had purchased for Kyla, the entirety of the night and the nightmare she had lived through settled like mist all around her. Heavy, ethereal, and quiet.
"You okay?"
Saxon whispered, seeming to sense her mood. Kiera wrung her hands together, glanced down at her lap, and slowly closed her eyes.
"No," she whispered back. "I'm still reeling, processing, just trying to take it all in."
She opened her eyes, glanced beyond Saxon's shoulder, and stared out a large picture window, admiring the sun rising over the canyon.
"For whatever it's worth," she said, "I think there are a few things that are crystal clear, even if I'm still digesting the rest."
He licked his bottom lip in an unconscious gesture, almost as if he were eager to taste her revelation.
"Can you tell me?"
She nodded.
"Yeah, I think so."
She glanced once again out the window. His gaze was just too penetrating, and the things she understood, the truths she had absorbed, were far too intimate and revealing to share while she looked him in the eyes.
"I know three things for certain,"
she began, losing herself in the lavender golden sky.
"The first, that you're not evil. You are not my enemy, no matter how frightening this seems, no matter how the future unfolds."
She heard his breath hitch, and then he grew unnaturally quiet, like a creature of the night becoming one with the shadows.
"Second," she pressed on, "I know that Kyla is. She's evil to the core. Perhaps she's always been."
She took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
"I also know that I'm going to need to face her eventually, before the princess claims her."
Her eyes filled with moisture, but she refused to cry over her twin.
"She's lost to me forever. I get that. I do. But I still need to seek some closure."
A pastel orange hue blended with the bottom of a white fluffy cloud, eclipsing its purple underbelly, and the azure blue sky that framed the silhouette provided a breathtaking backdrop.
"And last but not least, I know that I owe you an apology."
This time she turned to regard him and met his seeking gaze head on. She owed him at least that much. Saxon's stunning eyes swept over her features with pure, undiluted compassion.
"No, Kiera, you don't."
She smiled faintly.
"Yes, I do. If not an apology, then I owe you a thank you."
She held one finger in the air to keep him from interrupting. She needed to get this out.
"You saved my life, Saxon, and I can't tell you how grateful I am for your intervention. You figured it out. You found me. And you did what you had to. I don't blame you for that, even if it's terrifying. Kyla was the villain, not you."
She linked her fingers together and settled them in her lap.
"Beyond that, you slayed all the monsters."
Her voice cracked, and she tightened her interlocked fingers around the top of both hands, until her knuckles became mottled. She wanted to get this out without breaking down.
"That may sound theatrical, but it isn't. Owen and Travis, those vampire hunters, they were worse than any nightmare I've ever had. And if they were still here, if they were still living, I don't think I could bear it. I wouldn't survive. I'd be constantly looking over my shoulder, flinching at every noise, wondering where they were, and waiting for them to strike, to find me and finish the job. As it stands, Xavier is still out there, and that thought makes it hard to breathe.
He will never get anywhere near you, Saxon growled,
the smooth skin above his high sculpted cheekbones growing taut as he tightened his jaw.
I swear that to you, on my life and my honor as a sentinel.
She studied his expression, the narrowing of his gaze, the constriction in his lips, the barely perceptible hint of his fangs, and she knew he was telling the truth.
I believe you, she whispered. But all that aside, I wanted to thank you for something else as well.
His compelling, perfect eyebrows arched above his equally stunning eyes.
What's that?
He quietly rasped. She forced herself to smile and swept her hand in a wide circular arc, indicating the bedroom, his house, and the valley. Everything.
You could have handled this, all of this, so very badly. But you didn't. You handled it with patience, kindness, and honesty. You have treated me with, well, with grace. Even as I've treated you like just another captor. I know that you're not, Saxon. But it's going to take me time, not just to assimilate all the new information, not just to try and come to terms with the impossible, the blood curse, the vampire, the life that I'm facing, but to heal from the trauma I've been through, to locate enough of my center, to regain enough of my footing, to even try and take a single step forward from here. I honestly can't promise you anything.
She pressed her lips together and held her breath, waiting for his reply. At least she had gotten it out. Saxon shifted purposefully on the bed where he sat. He leaned toward her, reached out his hand, and then drew it back in hesitation. Everything in his expression, in his bearing, in his protective, territorial posture, told her he wanted to touch her, soothe her, hold her. But true to his generous nature, he was holding back, restraining that urge. Finally, after several pregnant moments had passed, he rubbed his thumb over the shadow on his jaw and whispered,
"What do you need from me, Angel?"
His captivating eyes nearly pierced her soul.
"Whatever it is, I will make it happen."
Like the perfect key sliding into a tumbler, the spring-loaded pins in Kiera's wounded heart lined up, and she almost heard the click of the track as her very core unlocked. While she wasn't completely open to Saxon's ominous world, while she didn't know if she could meet his advances, one thing was unerringly clear. This man, no, this vampire, was welcome to come in. He had already slipped past her defenses. Her mouth was suddenly dry, and she licked her lips to moisten them.
"As much as I desire to call my parents, to hear their familiar voices, as much as I need to face and confront my sister, to bring that chapter of my life to a close, what I really need is just to rest, in every sense of the word. I need to turn down the noise. I need to stop thinking, processing, and analyzing. I need to stop feeling everything, confused, terrified, afraid. Honestly, Saxon, I just want to take a couple days and rest, rehabilitate."
He shifted onto his knees, so seamlessly, so unobtrusively, it was like the slow, fluid motion of a silent jungle cat. And then he crept to Kiera, placed one knee on either side of her thighs, and cupped her jaw in his powerful yet gentle hands. He didn't say a word. He just stared into her eyes like he was reading her soul through her irises, his thumbs rotating softly in a calming, gentle motion. And then he bent his head and kissed her, with tenderness, with reverence, with love. Kiera closed her eyes and kissed him back, not passionately, not erotically, but with affection. He drew back, breathed soulfully against her mouth, then slid his lower lip back and forth just once against hers, before finally pulling away.
"You will rest as long as you need to, Yubito," he rasped. "And I will see to your every comfort. But first, there is something I want to give you." and I hope I have not overstepped my boundaries or made a misguided calculation.
His soft eyes brightened with anticipation.
I think it will help you heal.
He raised his forefinger, touched it to her nose, and smiled, as resplendent as the noonday sun.
I'll be right back.
Kiera's head was spinning, from the moment, from that kiss, as she waited quietly to see what Saxon had for her. Minutes later, he returned to the bedroom with a beautiful red violin case in his hand.
I know that this instrument you love was used against you as an instrument of torture, and I know that you may not want to play, perhaps never again.
His features grew solemn.
That's fine. You don't have to. This isn't for me. It's for you.
He set it on the bed, opened the clasps with tangible veneration, and slowly raised the lid.
This particular instrument is very special.
His lips quirked up in a knowing smile.
Our king, Napoleon Mondragon, traveled back and forth to Cremona, Italy, quite a bit during the 17th and 18th centuries. He collected beautiful works of art and rare artifacts. But this was his finest and rarest acquisition, a gift made for him by a friend.
He lifted the antique instrument out of the more modern case and turned it around so she could see it.
A craftsman by the name of Antonio Stradivari.
Kiera breathed in a whisper.
Saxon.
She couldn't help herself. She rocked onto her knees, crawled across the bed, and reached out for the instrument, cradling it like a baby.
This is an original Stradivarius? Made by the finest luthier of all time?
Her eyes clouded with tears, and a single drop escaped one corner.
Do you know what something like this would cost on the open market?
He chuckled.
Yeah, millions.
Yes,
she nodded emphatically.
But honestly, it's priceless. I've held one once or twice, but I never...
Her voice trailed off as she caressed the wood with the pads of her fingers, peered inside the F-holes, and read the antiquated label. Antonius Stradivarius Cremonensis Faciobat Anno, 1704.
Antonio Stradivari.
She spoke the name with reverence. Then she handed the instrument back to Saxon because she had to shield her eyes. She was crying like a baby, and there was no way she could hold it back.
When did you do this?
She asked.
How did you get it? Why did your king agree? I can't accept this, Saxon. I can't accept something so...
Shh, he hushed her. You can, and you will. Nothing would give the king greater pleasure than to one day hear this exquisite instrument played as it was meant to be. My brother Santos picked it up from the king's manse and brought it to me late last night while you slept.
I spoke with Napoleon on the drive home from Denver, again while you were sleeping soundly. You should have heard his voice, Kiera. He was absolutely delighted. He quickly shifted to a different subject, as if he were afraid she might object again.
Don't get me wrong. I know that musicians marry their instruments. It takes years and years of playing, trading up, searching to find the perfect fit in every way. So we will bring your primary violin from Denver to Darkmoon Vale, and anything else you need. But this is a gift from the king to you, and I hope it will serve as medicine to mend your wounded soul. Tell me you will take it, Kiera. Nothing would please me more.
Kiera swiped her tears with the back of her hand and sniffled in a less-than-ladylike manner. It couldn't be helped. She stared at the exquisite case, with its beautiful velvet lining, and nodded, trying not to tear up again.
What had he done? How could he have known?
There was nothing on the planet, no, nothing in existence, that could have meant more or touched her more deeply. And after all she had been through over the last 9 days, it was more than a fresh breath of air. It was like a new beginning, a shining ray of hope. The burgeoning anticipation that maybe, even in the midst of a storm, or a never-ending nightmare, dreams could still come true.
Thank you,
she choked out tremulously. There was nothing else she could say. Adequate words did not exist.
33.
Later that night, Kitaro Silivasi pressed his finger against his lips and nodded silently to his youngest living son, Nakari.
I can hear someone breathing on the other side of the panel,
he said telepathically, referring to the large mahogany door annexing the top-floor penthouse in downtown Denver. They had tracked the Lycan Xavier to the lavish Swingle duplex suites. Apparently, the Alpha General enjoyed his creature comforts when he visited, and terrorized the inhabitants of Earth. Nakari's deep green eyes grew sapient.
Yeah, me too. Follow my lead,
Kitaro instructed, understanding intimately how dangerous an alpha male werewolf could be, especially if the beast felt cornered. Without hesitation, Kitaro Silivasi vanished from sight, reducing his physical form to its basic molecular structure, and flowed like fluid magma through the keyhole. He could have just rematerialized inside the opulent skyrise condo, but he wanted to approach the unknown from a lower vantage, toward the ground. Nakari followed suit, remaining close behind his father. Kitaro's supernatural senses flared out in all directions. He sniffed, he listened, he looked, and he felt, for any errant vibrations. Xavier Matista was not in the penthouse. Shimmering into full view atop a dazzling marble floor in the glass-enclosed open floor plan, he quickly spun around, just in case he had missed something in his ethereal body. And that's when he saw the woman, better described as a girl, perhaps something in between. She was hunkered over in a semi-fetal position at the edge of a platform bed, chained like an animal to a stake in the ground with a collar around her neck. Her wild amber hair, with highlights of golden brown, was filthy, matted, and tangled. Her naturally lean 5'6" frame looked disturbingly emaciated. Her body was covered in marks and bruises, mottled from head to toe, and there was something affixed to her right thigh. It looked like a piece of stationery. Despite her jarring condition, what caught Kitaro's attention the most were her large, terrified eyes. They were unlike anything he had ever seen before, huge, round, and silver-blue, like swirling crystal glass art or the surface of a mountain lake, shimmering beneath a beam of moonlight. Coupled with her thick, long, dark lashes, they were the eyes of a fairy princess, not a human captive. His breath hitched in his throat, and he looked askance at Nakari, who was already making his way toward the female.
Careful! Kitaro snarled, not understanding where the instinct came from. Don't hurt her!
Nakari furrowed his brow. He opened his mouth to say something, then briskly shook his head, apparently preferring to dismiss the thought. He dropped down in a lithe, limber squat, crouching like a tiger in front of her.
What is your name? He crooned softly. How did you come to be here?
The girl hissed like a rabid animal, scuttled backward toward the bed, and swiped at Nakari's face with a hand absent of claws. Then she immediately tucked her chin to her chest, threw a defensive arm up, and shrieked in abject terror. Nakari raised both hands in a gesture of surrender, trying to let her know he wasn't there to hurt her. Kitaro moved to Nakari's side and pitched his voice in the silken tone of coercion.
"Tell us who you are," he commanded. "Why are you in this penthouse?"
Her voice was raspy and raw as she obeyed the powerful compulsion.
"Zeta,"
she squeaked, clearing her throat to produce a better sound.
"How can I serve you?"
She reached out to stroke Kitaro's groin and hissed yet again when he shuffled backward and manacled her wrist in his fingers.
"No,"
he said it sternly. She shrank at the sound of his voice, this time quivering like a child and yanking on fistfuls of her wild hair.
"Holy Mother of Perseus," Nakari murmured. "She isn't right, in the head."
Kitaro slowly nodded.
"She's been abused beyond her mind's capacity to withstand," he added.
In a shift as nimble as a cobra, with a strike as fast as lightning, Zeta lunged forward and bit Kitaro's finger, catching her neck on the collar. Her dull human teeth sank deep into the digit. He caught her at the back of the neck in a powerful pincer grasp and gave her another command.
"Release me!"
She was instantly compelled to obey. Relaxing her jaw, she released Kitaro's finger and swiped her mouth with the back of her hand. And then, just like that, she switched again, going from feral to terrified animal.
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry!"
She rushed the words in a hurried sequence, sounding positively frantic.
Please, please don't hurt me. I'll never do it again.
She turned to plead with Nakari, batting those beautiful, mysterious eyes, and then she swiped at his face again.
Don't touch me!
Nakari veered out of her reach, easily avoiding her nails, and then he shook his head in a slow, pitying nod.
We're not going to get anything from this female, at least not now, and not like this.
Kitaro agreed wholeheartedly, clearing his throat to catch her attention and her momentary fairy princess gaze. He gave her another imperious command.
Be at ease, little one. Go to sleep.
Nakari caught her head in a gentle palm as it tilted to the side, careful to keep the collar from tugging against the chain and restricting her delicate airway. He reached forward with his free hand and crushed the metal links, freeing her from the restraint. Kitaro reached for the piece of stationery, affixed by a metal clasp to her thigh, and turned his nose up in revulsion when he realized what it was, a note written on the penthouse's guest stationery stapled to her flesh. And by the width and depth of the zinc-plated steel, it was clear that the note had been attached with a staple gun.
Son of a shit-eating hyena, Kitaro cursed beneath his breath. What kind of a bastard does this?
He snarled, removing the embedded wires from her flesh, and quickly scanned the missive.
Vampires, one and all, whoever finds this missive, salutations from the land of Mir. I trust you have found my pet. Please feel free to use her. She's like a wild cat, hungry, savage, and also responsive. Don't bother to track me all over the city. I've returned to my world beyond the portal. But do not fret. We'll meet again. When you least fucking expect it. General Matista.
Kitaro crumpled the note in his hand. Saxon would be so disappointed, and who could honestly blame him? He relayed the contents of the note to Nakari, rose from his perch in front of the girl, and strode across the penthouse, sniffing out each corner, searching for remnants of Xavier's occupation, for data or any clues, trying to restrain his temper. He wanted revenge for his family, and for Saxon. He wanted to break the Lycan's neck. And from his many years fighting as a slave in the Lycos arena, he didn't have a single doubt that he could do it. Quickly, efficiently, and with brutal finality. He turned to regard his youngest living son, who had lifted the girl from the floor, removed the offensive collar, and placed her on the bed, covering her battered naked body with the velvet gold coverlet.
Master Wizard, he addressed him with his formal title. Your touch is safer than mine, and your mind probes are much, much cleaner. Deeper, faster, far more efficient. Try to read her recent thoughts, retrieve her short-term memories, and if necessary, go back all the way to the date of her birth. I want to know who she is and where she comes from. I want to know how she came to be here, in this expansive top-floor penthouse with a Lycan from another world. I want to know what he did to her and why he let her live. And we don't have a month to funnel through a string of a trillion impressions. Search for the Lycan's imprint. Search for the vibration of fear. Sort through the myriad of supernatural encounters, and relay them as you go. I will continue to scour the apartment, try to find Xavier's lease, see if he left anything of value behind.
He glanced out a floor-to-ceiling window, staring at the city lights.
Son, do you know anything about this particular building, these specific penthouses, anything that might be relevant to our enemy's earthbound organization? To Xavier.
Nakari lifted Zeta's left arm and began to test her veins, rubbing his thumb along the pale green tracks beneath her mottled flesh.
I believe the Swingle Duplex Suites are owned by an extremely wealthy corporation, Giovanni Inc., and their use is, well, highly dubious. From what I understand, there are 2 20,000-square-foot units on each private floor, but the condos are not for sale. They're rented like hotels by the week, the month, or the year, borrowed by extremely wealthy patrons.
He glanced at the naked woman lying on the luxurious bed and cocked both eyebrows to emphasize his point.
As you can see, they're used for all kinds of nefarious dealings, including prostitution.
Finding a vein that suited him, Nakari released one claw, nicked the female's flesh, and brought her arm an inch from his mouth. But I don't know if there's any direct connection to Xavier, or the Lycans. Giovanni Inc. is a multi-billion-dollar conglomerate. The investors own half of this city and a large portion of several others, all along the East Coast and the Midwest. Marquise and Giovanni Inc. have never had a single run-in concerning the casino, so they don't appear to meddle in their competitors' affairs. He lowered his head and lapped at Zeta's blood. And then he froze in mid-swallow, drew back to release his fangs, and plunged them directly into the brachial artery instead.
"What is it?"
Kitaro asked, instantly catching the shift in approach. Nakari wanted a much larger taste. He needed a broader stream of information.
"The vibrations in her blood,"
Nakari responded telepathically.
"This human woman is part Lycan."
Kitaro flashed to Nakari's side in an instant, braced his large, powerful hand along the base of the female's neck, and raised her head just high enough to scent the underside of her jaw. He took a deep, full-bodied sniff, swirled his tongue along her jugular, and stiffened.
"You're right. What the hell?"
He sniffed her again and recoiled. He would know that faint secondary scent anywhere. That almost imperceptible familiar taint wafting from the deepest recesses of the female's DNA. It belonged to Xavier Matista. And that meant the two creatures were related. Blessed Goddess Andromeda. Had Xavier done this to his own relation? Females were rare as hell in Mir, and while they were anything but cherished, they were kept very close to the alpha males. Used but protected. Abused but kept alive. Owned by their male mates and masters. They were not left to die in city penthouses on the other side of the portal.
"Sift through her memories. Go back to the beginning. Do it now, Nakari."
The master wizard retracted his fangs, closed his eyes, and swirled Zeta's blood around his tongue. He placed an absent hand over her heart to deepen the physical and spiritual connection, and then slowly, albeit at a much swifter pace than anyone other than a wizard could achieve, he began to relay various memories and impressions in a quiet, reflective tone.
"She's human, Father, at least to her own recollection."
Kitaro grew quiet, concentrating on every single word spoken by the Master Wizard. Nakari received more than facts and impressions. He received divine premonitions and psychic intimations.
"Xavier purchased her from a middleman about 2 weeks ago. Definitely a human trafficking ring, a sex trade operation. And then he brought her to this penthouse."
His eyebrows lifted in surprise.
"I can't be sure, because I only have access to Zeta's words and thoughts. But the two did not recognize each other. Xavier showed no familiar reaction. If they're related, they don't seem to know it. And there's something else that stands out."
His features relaxed once more.
"She wasn't feral at the time. She was petrified, disgusted, sad, and spiritually broken. I would say she was resigned, but her mind was sound."
"Whoa," he suddenly intoned. "A shitpot of money exchanged hands for her purchase."
"How much?"
Kitaro thought the words, not wanting to break the vampire's train of thought or concentration, to interrupt the deep psychic connection.
$150,000.
Kitaro felt his heart sink in his chest. He wasn't intimately acquainted with human criminal enterprises, but he knew enough to put 2 plus 2 together. Men didn't pay $150,000 for 2 weeks with a prostitute, not even a high-class call girl. That was blood money. Xavier was paying for the right to keep her, to never return the merchandise, to do whatever he chose with her body, including torture or kill her. So Giovanni Inc. was as corruption came, and Xavier knew just who to turn to.
Interesting. "She wasn't new to the life," Nakari continued. "I'm streaming really fast, tunneling through weeks, months, years of memories and impressions. And they're all the same, going back as far as 13 years old. Zeta lived in a compound, a virtual walled-in fortress, with a host of other sex slaves. Shit, it looks like she grew up there. She was traded for years and years, but never sold for torture. Not until Xavier. His expression darkened. I'm looking everywhere I can, Father, but I'm just not finding the Lycan connection. She never leaves the compound unless she's with a John. She never passed through the portal. She never spent a moment of her life in Mir. I can't be absolutely certain from such a limited perusal of impressions, but based on everything I'm getting, she doesn't know she's part Lycan. She's never had anything to do with them. Kitaro rubbed his hands together, growing increasingly perplexed and restless.
Dig deeper, son. Go further. Can you travel back to her infancy? Can you crawl inside her mother's womb? Try to divine an impression of her father?
Nakari pursed his lips together and let out a measured stream of breath, and Kitaro knew he was asking for a miracle. Such a thing would require more than a mind meld or a memory retrieval. It would require the use of great magic. The Master Wizard bit down on his lower lip, furrowed his brow in concentration, and spoke several words in Latin, a spell of some sort.
"She's still in the compound," he said softly. "She's in a one-room, sterile cubicle with another human woman. A very attractive woman."
He grew still, and then he sighed.
"Her mother was a sex slave, too. Zeta was born to the life. She was born in the slave trade's fortress."
His shoulders tensed, his lower jaw tightened, and his eyelids began to flutter without opening.
"I'm in her mother's womb now. And I'm hearing one name more than any other. It's being spoken to the woman who is carrying her. Zia. Her mother's name is Zia, and she's definitely a sex slave. Zeta was an unplanned pregnancy, the result of a one-night transaction with a John."
All at once, a bolt of purple-blue lightning sizzled in the Denver night sky. Thunder clapped, rattling the penthouse, and the expansive cosmopolitan space filled with luminous light.
"I'm still in her mother's womb."
The vampire's voice sounded distant, disembodied, almost ghostly. And Kitaro knew what the Master Wizard was trying to do. He was trying to recreate and capture the moment of Zeta's conception so that he could snatch a fleeting impression, the identity of her father.
"Holy shit,"
he exclaimed, blanching and flying backward off the bed, instantly breaking the connection. Kitaro approached him cautiously. Nakari looked positively ashen.
"What is it, son? What did you see, or feel, or sense?"
Nakari stared at the female on the bed with a mixture of revulsion, pity, and disbelief in his eyes as he slowly shook his head.
"Xavier is Zeta's father."
Kitaro visibly recoiled.
"What?"
He followed his son's haunted gaze to the piteous, tortured soul sleeping on the bed.
"He did this to his daughter? To his own flesh and blood?"
Nakari shook his head.
"Honestly, I don't think he knew."
He took a moment to slowly exhale, as if purging the profanity from his lungs.
"I think it was one of the world's most effed-up coincidences. 20 years ago, he bought a human woman from a sex trafficking ring, brutalized her for one night, and likely went back through the portal. 20 years later, he bought another one," Kitaro supplied.
"I think so," Nakari offered. "Only this time, he purchased her for 2 weeks in order to exploit, torture, and kill her." He paused to catch his breath. "For what it's worth, which isn't much, this particular female was not the general's cup of tea. From what I saw, he never consummated their union. He got off on cruelty, the torture, and watching others do it for him."
"Well, no wonder she thought we were here for—"
"Yeah," Nakari murmured. He ran an absent hand through his thick, wavy black hair. He appeared fatigued, drained, completely tapped out. He opened his mouth to speak, but there truly were no words.
"And you think it was just a coincidence?
That he happened to purchase his daughter?" Nakari finished Kitaro's sentence again.
"I do."
Kitaro slowly nodded, then sighed as the information sank in.
"What are we going to do with her, Father?"
"We're going to take her back to Dark Moon Vale," Kitaro said bluntly. To Napoleon's manse?
No, Kitaro said. I'm going to take her back to the old house, to the cabin.
Nakari drew back in surprise.
The home where we grew up? The home where my mother lived?
Father.
He sounded positively dumbstruck. Innocent victim or not, the female is half Lycan. Not to mention she's deeply damaged, broken, dangerous. She's feral.
Kitaro stared at the female lying so peacefully on the bed, and he replayed her earlier reactions, the hissing, the cowering, the salacious overture, the fact that she belonged to a primordial race of the vampire's eternal enemies, the fact that the vampire-hunting instinct was woven into her blood, and he understood his son's objections. Ever since the Silavasi brothers had returned from Mir with their father in tow, Kitaro had divided his time between his cherished son's houses and the old isolated cabin where he had once lived with Serena. While he resided with his sons, he poured all his free time and extra energy into remodeling, revitalizing, and reanimating the original homestead. It was where he felt closest to his departed destiny, to her spirit. Now to take not only a mortal enemy, but the child of a monster who knew and conspired with the one who had murdered his beloved wife back to the pristine valley, back to the home where Serena had given birth to their sons. It seemed almost sacrilegious. Zeta stirred fitfully on the bed, her feral fairy princess eyes fluttering open. And Kitaro had his answer. He too had been held captive for much of his life. He too had been brutalized by depraved Lycans. He would nurse the female back to health, or euthanize her himself. But she wasn't staying with Napoleon.
34. 3 days later. Saxon Olaru practically held his breath, waiting to be transfixed by Kiera's plane. She had done as she'd intended, taken 3 full days to sleep, try to heal and rejuvenate, leaving all other cares and obligations behind. And now she was finally ready to try her new violin. He sank into the plush, comfortable cushions of his overstuffed sofa and bit his bottom lip in anticipation. By all the gods, his destiny was lovely, standing before him like a pajama-clad angel, wearing his silken PJs, and Saxon was feeling everything he should, and then some, for this rare, incomparable beauty. Her posture as she tucked the timeless instrument beneath her chin, readied her bow and placed it noiselessly on the string, was mesmerizing. Her tall, elegant form was almost regal, and for a moment Saxon absently wondered if her new vampiric abilities might turn her into a preternatural virtuoso. After all, she was faster now, her mind was keener, her fingers could move with unerring precision. She could bow at any speed or velocity she chose, recall notes without even trying, and employ the most difficult hand positions or vibrato as if it were second nature. From what he'd seen in Kyla's memories, what he'd found in Kiera's too, his destiny was already a master of the instrument. What in the name of the gods would she play like now? The first languorous notes began to vibrate throughout the canyon-top great room with the lofty resonance of a cathedral recital, and he immediately caught his breath. It hitched in his throat. And then she played a series of flawless transcendent tones, and his heart actually skipped a beat.
"Wait," he whispered, loath to stop her, but unable to contain the urge.
Her bow halted on the string, and she brought the instrument down to her side, tucking it beneath her arm in its natural resting position.
"What is it?"
she asked, instantly concerned.
"What's wrong?"
He shook his head.
"Nothing. Nothing's wrong. Everything is right."
His head still swimming from the jolt of that song, he leaned forward in his seat and asked,
"What in heaven's name is that song? And why did you choose to play it? Just now, for me?"
He waited with bated breath to hear her answer. When she just looked at him perplexed, her beautiful mouth turned down in a frown, he clarified,
"I apologize for stopping you, but I've heard that song before, in a dark, desolate alley during one of the bleakest nights of my life, the gravest night of this entire ordeal. at least before the night I found you in that warehouse. And I've heard it before in a premonition of sorts, the night you called out to me.
This time it was Kiera's breath that hitched, and her eyes grew soft and smoky.
You heard me? The times I tried to call out to you?
Saxon nodded.
Not every time, he said. But that particular night, I heard you. And I was staggered by the sound of your voice. Your name. But I wasn't able to make sense of it.
She glanced away, as if considering all that had happened.
The song,
she finally murmured, bringing her gaze back to his.
I have known this song forever, but I haven't played it in years. At least I hadn't until the warehouse. Until Xavier.
Saxon almost stopped her there. He didn't want her to relive unpleasant memories, but he really needed to hear her full answer. His soul was drifting toward the music, toward Kiera and this song, like a merchant vessel out to sea finally turning toward home. Anxious, longing, seeking to grasp the sanctuary of the familiar. Kiera shut her eyes. Maybe it was easier that way.
My first full day at the warehouse, following the night of my capture, the night of the blood moon, the first time I met Xavier, I was terrified, to put it mildly. I didn't know what he wanted, what he was planning to do with me, and I was too horrified to even consider the vile possibilities. But then he commanded me to play the violin, and it inspired the faintest spark of hope. Maybe if I could enthrall him, please him, distract him, maybe he would let me live. At least as long as I could play. But honestly, that hope was immediately replaced with dread because there was no way, just no way I could play this sweet instrument for that horrifying man. My fingers were not going to work. My mind was not going to settle. And I was shaking too hard to even hope to wield a bow.
Kiera.
Saxon held up his hand to stop her, about to rise and go to her side, but she opened her eyes, stared at her new violin, as if the very sight of it might give her courage, and pressed on.
It's okay. I'm curious about this, too.
Her voice grew hushed and slightly tremulous as she continued to recall that day.
Anyhow, I forced myself to concentrate, and then I placed the bow on the strings. Figuring it was now or never, all or nothing, I prepared to wow him with something extremely technical and difficult, a caprice or an intricate fugue. But the oddest thing